everybody. Welcome back for another great and fun episode of Chop On. If you're joining us for the very first time, thank you so much for listening, and we hope that you enjoy the show. We appear every Wednesday in the U.S. at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Thursday morning in India and Australia at 6 a.m. IST and 10 a.m. ACST. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Chop On Pod. We have our link tree attached to those pages to find the right podcast platform for you to listen to it. Once you find that platform, please like, rate, review, but most importantly, make sure you subscribe to your favorite podcast that blends together cricket with wrestling. And Bharat, we have heard from a pretty prominent name here that cricket and wrestling being blended together here on Chop On is the new Milk and Cookies.
Milk and Cookies and apple pie and cream, as they say in this part of the world, Rajiv. It was funny, right? Like how that whole worked out. It wasn't planned. It wasn't a shoot. It just happened. Like you called into Eric Bischoff and Conrad's radio show for the Heat last week. And they were just raving about how intelligent, how cool, how smart a guy you were, and how you have. And Eric started talking about our podcast, this podcast, and how cricket and wrestling are the new Milk and Cookies. And then they go, okay, caller, who's up? And it's me. So it was, we couldn't have asked for better promotion, like, you know, a better unplanned promotion than that. Yeah, seriously, it was very well done to you and me. And thank you, as always, to Eric Bischoff. And he's so right. I mean, I think the universe is conspiring as well, Rajiv. I have to say this. So recently, there's some friends of mine here in Australia who started a cricket daily podcast, right? So they do 15 minutes every day. I actually recorded my first. I'm a recurring guest, as they call it. I was on this morning for 15 minutes. So day before, Andrew Menzel, who's the main host, He tweeted a picture saying, oh, we're doing so well, like, you know, on Apple Podcasts and all that. And, you know, for me, that didn't stand out. So they are number 127 now, Cricket Daily. It's great. They started last week. Most listened to podcast. Look at number 128. It's busted open.
Oh.
So I'm like, wow, look at that. So cricket and wrestling. That's what we do. That's what we do. I think, man, trust me. I think we've set in motion a chain of events, which is already bringing the two worlds together. As I love to say on the show, but we're getting closer and closer to an actual union. And you know who will be emceeing the actual union? Eric Bischoff.
This is true. And for those that do not know, he is the best hair in journalism, Bharat Sundaresan. My name is Rajiv, and we are going to take you on this journey down the aisle to get this union of cricket and wrestling together. And Bharat, we have the England-New Zealand test that will have already started by the time this podcast hits the airwaves. And so just to peek behind the curtain and break a little kayfabe here, we are recording this before day one starts. So being our resident cricket expert here on the show, what can fans who might be tuning in expect out of this two test series?
And before I come to that, Rajiv, that is taking our listeners behind the curtains. We are still in, as a show, we're still in around 95 when wrestling was still recorded before Nitro came along and changed everything. So, you know, someday we will go live, but we need competitions. So, you know, otherwise, what's the point? So maybe not anytime soon, but maybe somewhere down the line. But England and New Zealand, just the start of the test summer in England, it's something very special. I mean, I know I live in Australia. There's something very special about the Australian cricket summer. But just the way it leads up to the English summer, it's very different. I think also goes back to the fact that let's face it, that's where cricket came into being. And they have a lovely way of building it up, right? Like the county season begins sometime towards the end of April, May. And, you know, you start hearing all these names, county players, and Darren Stevens at 45 doing amazing things. We could dedicate a whole episode to that legend.
Absolutely.
And, you know, they build it up beautifully. And I remember, you know, when I was growing up, June, the third week of June is when schools would start. the academic year would start in India. So, and that's in Bombay, that's when the monsoons start. So, like, you know, they bring back some great, great memories. Like, so you're kind of preparing for school. The rains have just started, and Bombay rains are unreal. You know, you can smell that. There's a smell of wet mud everywhere. It's just beautiful, wet soil. The ground really kind of speaks to you. And there's the first test match of the English summer just about to start. It's very special. And regardless of who England are playing, and historically they've had the, how do I put it, the not the big three countries play in the early half of the season. Right now, New Zealand is the number one ranked team in the world. But, you know, you generally see a West Indies or a Sri Lanka, you know, play during May and June, or at least in June. And then the big team of the summer, whether it's the Ashes with Australia or India this time, they'll start playing their test series from July, late July or August. So, and it never has mattered who the opposition is. It just kind of kicks off the cricket summer in many ways. And you know what to expect. Lords, not the most impressive ground I've visited, I will tell you that much. The cakes that get offered during the lunch break, during the tea break, are out of this world. I mean, there's no comparison. But yeah, there's just, that's one kind of cricket romance that I can never get over. Like, you know what I mean? There's some things that you just can't, you'll always get giddy thinking about it. So I'm very excited, even though having built it all up, it starts at 7 p.m. my time. So I can't stay up, but it'll be very late by the time the test finish, or the day's play finishes. I did watch a lot of it last year when the West Indies were playing. But from a cricketing sense, you have, in my opinion, the best, the most settled bowling attack, most potent, some might say, in the world, in New Zealand, with Saudi. Bolt's not playing the first game, but Wagner and Jameson, you know, and throw a Matt Henry in there. It's a great bowling attack. And you have the number one ranked test batsman in the world, Kane Williamson, who's always special to watch. Going up against an England outfit who, you know, we'll see some new names, James Bracey behind the stumps. I haven't seen much of him. Ollie Robinson might make his debut. You know, Jofra Archer injured, and some of their IPL returnees still resting of sorts. They're not completely full strength, but, you know, they have a lot to prove to themselves after the drubbing they took in India. So there's just, you can see, I can keep talking about the English summer because it's, it's a special time in the year. It's very different now that I moved to Australia. It's the start of winter here. So it's getting really cold. But yeah, I will be snuggled up with a glass of wine watching the test match this evening.
And it starts at 3 a.m. my time. So I will probably be watching day one later on, because I don't think I'm going to get up that early to watch it. But hey, who knows? I've done crazy things like that before. And, you know, speaking of cricket and you being in Australia, they just appointed a new CEO. So what can you tell us about Nick Hockley? I don't think I've ever heard his name before personally.
And he is the most understated of cricket administrators I've ever seen. Nick Hockley, of course, comes originally from England. He has spent a lot of time in Australia, but he is English. He comes from the great city of Birmingham, which, of course, is the birthplace to a lot of things, including heavy metal and Black Sabbath and Led Zeppelin. So, but yeah, Nick Hockley is... nothing about him screams Black Sabbath or Led Zeppelin, but he's just a very quiet yet extremely efficient operator when it comes to cricket administration. He's been part of a few major events in sport in terms of you know, managing the commercial and marketing sides. He was head of commercial negotiations for the London Olympics in 2012 and the Paralympics. And he briefly moved to Australia in the early 2000s, did some work here, then he went back. But his cricketing credentials really grew with the 2015 World Cup, which was in Australia and New Zealand, where, again, he was general manager for the commercial side, the marketing side. And he was the CEO for the women's T20 World Cup last year in Australia, where you saw over 80,000 people, 86,000 people watch India and Australia play that final. So that was one of the most successful events in terms of crowds and just participation in women's sport. And that's where his name really came to the fore. And he was still a CEO for what was supposed to be the T20 World Cup in Australia in 2020, last year. But that's when the pandemic happened, and it changed everyone's life around, and it changed his life around, because a few months into the pandemic last year, Kevin Roberts, who was then the CEO, parted ways with Cricket Australia. There were issues with contracts and a lot of things. And Nick Hockley was appointed as the interim CEO around June, July last year. And that's also around the time you realize that the T20 World Cup wasn't happening in Australia. So it was pushed to 2022. So, you know, Nick Hockley had no World Cup to manage. So Cricket Australia made a very smart move of getting Nick Hockley on board. And he had a testing summer. I mean, talk about baptism by fire. He had to deal with the BCCI on numerous occasions, to convince them to come here. And then, as you know, it didn't help, like the likes of Bharat Sundaresan made his life very difficult by writing stories about how the Indian team didn't want to leave Sydney and go to Brisbane, and how difficult their life was within the biosecure bubble, and how their rights had been expounded. So yeah, a lot of things were happening, but he handled it great. And not just by being calm and in a very passive fashion, but he was very firm without ever raising his voice or without ever, you know, coming across as being too forthright. So I thought he handled the summer beautifully, and it's a great pick. And now he's been given the full-time job. And just to like, you know, sum up how just a nice guy he is overall, they did a Zoom call yesterday or day before, like, you know, once he was announced as the new CEO. And I was having my lunch, like, while the Zoom call was on. So, like, by the time I could type, and Indians eat with their hands, fingers. So by the time I could type my question in, it was too late. So the Zoom call, like, you know, the lady conducting the call said, I don't think we are getting any more questions. We are done. So I'm like, damn, I was too slow. Then I get a call from Cricket Australia, the head of communications. And he's like, Nick is here. He saw your message. And he said, no, we need to give Bharat his chance. So he can ask his questions privately to me. And like, not many people in cricket administration would do that anywhere in the world. So it just tells you he's a really genuine guy. And as he's proved, he's very efficient at what he does.
Not just cricket, it's sport in general. Not a lot of administrators would do that. So yeah. Hey, good on him for doing that, and good on us for continuing week 6 of Chop On. If you've never listened to us before, we are going to take topics related to cricket and wrestling, the new milk and cookies, and discuss them for 5 minutes maximum each. If we end the topic before the 5 minute mark, then that's fantastic. Otherwise, we're going to cut ourselves off at the 5 minute mark. We know we have listeners that love cricket but don't love wrestling, or they love wrestling and maybe don't love cricket, so we try to educate our listeners by having a new term or rule of the week, and also a history lesson. So, brother, are you ready to do this thing this week?
I couldn't be readier than this, Rajiv. Let's do this, Rahiv.
All right, Bharat, we're going to rotate the strike. I will present topics and we will go back and forth discussing these. And here is our very first topic. Let's start with big news out of USA Cricket. USA Cricket has announced the launch of their new intra-regional women's competition this week. The intra-regionals, to be held starting on June 14th, are designed to supplement existing local women's competitions and form the first step of the new domestic structure, which hopes to establish a clear pathway for female players from grassroots through representative cricket. Four geographic regions with 12 total teams will compete in T20 and 40 over matches to showcase their skills on the regional stage in front of selectors. After completion of the competition, four regional teams will be selected to compete in a series of two T20s and two 50 over matches in July. From there, players will be selected to represent the Western Conference and the Eastern Conference in the Senior Women's and Women's Under-19 National Championships from August 11th through 13th over four T20s. The Women's Senior and Women's Under-19 National squads will be selected following the Senior and Under-19 National Championships. Bharat, how big of a deal is this for an emerging cricket country to have a women's pathway, and for Cricket USA to be taken seriously? Is a women's team a step in that direction?
Firstly, it's really sad that the USA is still considered an emerging country when it comes to cricket. It just tells you that not just at the ICC level, but we've had so much controversy in USA cricket. You know, at one point there were two factions trying to run USA cricket. When they made it to the men's team, made it to the ICC Champions Trophy in 2004, a lot of people around the world thought, yeah, I mean, this is the beginning of something. But, you know, here we are 17 years later. It's still in a developmental stage, but purely when it comes to women's cricket, I think it's great because there's always a lot of talk of like, yes, you want to spread the game and, have more teams in these big ICC events. I mean, we're talking about this on a day when the ICC have officially announced, we all knew about it, they officially announced that the World Cups going forward will, not the 2023 one, but from the 2024 World Cup onwards, men's World Cups, they'll go back to 14 teams, and the Women's World Cup will also, the team number of teams will be increased, which is what you want. Like I tweeted sometime back, the world is coming back to the World Cup. So the ICC is taking great decisions on at their level, but it's so important that national associations and bodies and governing bodies also invest a lot of, not just money, but invest a lot of energy in setting up the system. And a pathway like this is exactly what is required. And women's cricket is growing very rapidly. We spoke earlier, I remember me talking about women's cricket being the way women will, lay the path that'll take cricket to the Olympics. And I can see that happening. And you need a strong USA team for that. Let's face it. You want Americans invested in their sport because they're watching their own team. This is great. It also tells you how massive a country America is. You heard Jeff Jarrett on the show comparing Australia to America, but a lot of Australia is still unoccupied. Like Central Australia, there's not too much. It's not inhabited. Unlike America, you have people everywhere. So it's very important to have that pathway so that you don't miss out on any talent anywhere. And of course, from a chop on sense, Rahiv, what stood out for me was the two T20s and the 250 over matches you spoke about, which will follow the intra regionals, will be held in North Carolina and Houston, Texas. When you think of North Carolina, you think of Ric Flair. When you think of Houston, Texas, you think of The Undertaker. So, I'm sure they have not taken that into consideration at all before announcing the venues for these four games. But it stood out for me. For me, America still, I see America through the eyes of, through wrestling. And ad-free shows. Like whenever I hear a new town or a new place, I go and quickly Google it just to see where that place exists. Like you'll be interested to know that 2 days ago I Googled Sacramento just to kind of pinpoint it on the map, because of course my co-host is Sacramento's finest. it's just really positive news that, rather than just sit and complain about the global body not giving you enough opportunities, that you are creating a system, a grassroots system, which can be easily replicated at even more junior levels. And then, like I said, not only are you not missing out on talent, but you're also giving all these girls, young girls and young women an opportunity, enough opportunities to prove themselves. And trivia, that the chair of the USA Women and Girls Committee, Nadia Gruny, also happens to be their have the record for the highest individual score. I Googled it.
No, I agree with you. Like it's really easy that they could just sit there and complain that the ICC is not taking them serious enough. But I mean, the fact that they're building their men's team, the fact that they've come up with this pathway, it's huge. And it's huge for cricket in America. And I do think that a women's team, whether it's the senior women's team or the under 19 team, that's just going to help with cricket being taken seriously. Most major sports here in America have a women's team as well. Like baseball has softball teams, basketball has women's basketball, soccer, which actually women's soccer, if you ask me, is taken way more seriously in America than men's soccer. But that's just to name a few. And, you know, I had worried that the U.S. Cricket Board was focusing on growing the men's side maybe a bit too much. But, you know, it's very nice to see that they're not only working on it behind the scenes, but they're making this announcement to let everybody know that they're working on it. And I think it's still tough for cricket in America as they're not being considered big players, as we were talking about. I mean, they don't have a broadcasting deal in place. Maybe they need to get bigger for that to happen. But, you know, most people that I know don't even know that there's an American team. So that says it all right there. So there's still some hills to climb, but this is a giant step in the right direction.
And just on that, Rajiv, I have to say, you know, we've been seeing some wonderful pictures and clips of our ad-free shows, family at AEW Dynamite and Double or Nothing. And, you know, they've had such a great time and they've brought so much atmosphere to that event. Maybe my dream is there will be a Chopon family who will all, like, you know, similarly gather around and watch a big cricket event in the USA, and we'll be responsible for it. That's my ultimate dream, and I can see it happening.
That is the dream. And another dream, WWE and New Japan Pro Wrestling are reportedly having talks about a possible working relationship. According to the Wrestling Observer newsletter, WWE President and Chief Revenue Officer Nick Khan has been in talks with New Japan officials about WWE possibly becoming the official American partner for the Japanese organization. New Japan currently is working with AEW and Impact Wrestling, and in the past has had a working relationship with Ring of Honor and CMLL. The talks apparently report date back to late March or early April, and the deal reportedly would include WWE sending wrestlers, including top stars, to work in New Japan Pro Wrestling. AEW President and CEO Tony Khan, in a video on Twitter with Tony Schiavone, cut a promo mocking how well these talks were going, since New Japan has been working consistently with AEW since the reported talks had started, and ended his promo saying, I quote, "I think there's only room for one Khan in the wrestling business, and it's me, Tony Khan, not some con man from Connecticut." The question here is, do you think these talks between WWE and New Japan Pro Wrestling are legitimate, or do you think WWE is trying to stir the pot? I think this is WWE trying to stir the pot. If there had been anything legitimate here, why would New Japan continue to go work with AEW when it's well documented that WWE is not a fan of AEW? Now, yes, I know people will say Chris Jericho was on the Broken Skull Sessions with Stone Cold Steve Austin on the WWE Network, but that's Chris Jericho. I don't think that Vince McMahon would let anybody that has never had a relationship with WWE on that show. Like, you won't see a Ricky Starks or an Orange Cassidy or the Young Bucks sitting down with Steve. I mean, I do think maybe WWE had preliminary talks with New Japan that either have been kind of left up in the air, and this is their way of saying, hey guys, we still want to get this going, or maybe it's non-existent now, and that's why WWE is trying to stir the pot and maybe try to cause friction between AEW and New Japan. I don't know, but I don't think Tony Khan would have cut such a promo on Twitter if New Japan had legitimately been thinking about doing a deal with WWE. So if anything, that promo that he did told me that even if New Japan does a deal with WWE, then it's going to be a light deal that's going to allow for them to continue to work with AEW in the future. So do I think that this was legitimate? Yes, at one point, but not now. And the news coming out of WWE, this news coming out, I should say, is WWE trying to stir the pot.
Or is it Tony Khan turning into a young Eric Bischoff? I don't know. I saw that promo. And but before I get going, just to put it out there, Tony Khan and Nick Khan are not related. firstly, Tony Khan is of Pakistani origin. His dad, of course, came from Lahore, and Nick Khan is of Iranian descent. So there's two very different countries. Khan, like you spoke about, there's only one Khan, but two very different Khans. Let's just put it there. I don't know. Could this, and this could just be the romantic in me, could this be the beginning of a on-air kayfabe WWE versus AEW angle? I don't know. You know, AEW is starting their own show. They're expanding. And let's face it, I don't think wrestling promotions think along the lines of, especially, you can't go and compete with WWE. We've spoken about it so many times. As a company, right? I mean, the AEW is still growing rapidly, but it's still 2 years old. Like, you know, it's not a fair comparison. And we've heard a lot of people much, much more learned and much, much more experienced in the industry, like Eric and so many others, who have explained why that is the case. But just hearing Tony Khan cut that promo, unless we're going to see more of him in the ring, not performing, we have seen his gym videos, I've seen on social media, but could he become an on-screen character? And you're talking about someone, I was listening to the latest What Happened When, and just the amount of recall he's supposed to have with wrestling, and just how much he loves wrestling. I just don't see him not becoming an on-screen character at some point. You know, so maybe this was just him trying out. I saw his quotes after that saying he had spoken to New Japan Pro Wrestling before he cut the promo, just to check if he can go ahead and say that. But having said all that, will the WWE just, could it just be bad reporting? Maybe someone pushed the gun, which is also possible. Not slamming the newsletter or Dave Meltzer here, but, you know, Dave Meltzer is an AEW mark by a distance. So, and one thing we've learned from Dave Meltzer is he does not report things as news. There's always that, what I tell junior young journalists not to do, you don't add your opinion to a report. You add an opinion to an op-ed piece, like, you know, which is called an opinionated editorial piece. But, could it have been bad reporting? Because I also read another report on another website which said that they're using Daniel Bryan as an in-between, the WWE is. That New Japan Pro Wrestling are really interested in Daniel Bryan. And, you know, that could be a way. But, it's interesting. I don't think we can bury the issue yet. But I was very intrigued more by just Tony Khan's promo. And just the way he was trying to come across as a character. He was, you know, not just with what he said about Nick Khan, but just overall, just his demeanor. I think, I'm sure Tony Schiavone would know better, considering he was there. But I'm not ruling it out, Rahib. Maybe we are heading towards a WWE-AEW battle, but this time it's not the Monday Night Wars. It's not a real battle. It's a scripted battle.
Yeah, I don't want Tony Khan to become an on-screen character, because the few times that he's done anything like this, he has looked very uncomfortable. So I don't know if he needs more practice or if he's just doing these one-offs just to do them. Tony Khan, please stay behind the scenes. That's where I want you. Rangana Herat, Sri Lanka's legendary left arm spinner, is the front runner to replace Daniel Vettori as Bangladesh's spin bowling coach. The BCB cricket operation chairman, Akram Khan, another Khan, confirmed the development to CricBuzz, adding that they will be taking the final call soon. The Bangladesh spin bowling coach's post went vacant after Daniel Vettori was unable to join them on a regular basis due to the pandemic. The BCB opted to fill the role with local spin coach Sohail Islam during the two-match test tour of Sri Lanka, and even though he has enough support in the dressing room, he won't be able to join the squad in Zimbabwe after opting for paternal leave. CricBuzz understands that India's Siraj Bahutale, did I pronounce that right, Bharat?
Siraj Bahutale, yeah.
Okay, and Pakistan's Saeed Ajmal are the other two candidates in BCB's list. Bharat, first, just as a quick history lesson for people before you get into your answer, can you explain why national sides have someone outside their country on their coaching staff? And then, to tie it back into this, is Rangana Herat the right way to go, or is one of the other two options better?
That's actually a very good question, Rajiv. And it's been a trend. It's been going on for years. Initially, if you look at cricket, the only teams who would have foreign coaches would be teams who are coming up from the developmental, to use a wrestling term. When you would have a new team like a Sri Lanka, Gary Sobers, the great Sir Garfield Sobers, used to be their coach in the 80s and maybe even the early 90s, but definitely in the 80s. Or a Zimbabwe when they started out, you would have a foreign coaches of at least, especially coaches or former cricketers of great renown who would go and help these countries kind of develop into or ease their way into international cricket. Then in the mid to late 90s, other countries, when the coaching staff started to grow, they realized that by having these foreign coaches, you could, but let me put it the other way. By just sticking to your own, you're really limiting your exposure in terms of know-how, in terms of understanding how it is to play in different conditions. Because cricket, unlike any other sport, is so dependent on conditions, right? It's on pitches, on weather, everything changes. When you go for an Indian cricketer to come and play in Australia, for a New Zealand cricketer to go and play in Sri Lanka, it's completely different. So that's when they started doing that. Initially, it used to be more about like if one country or if a country is touring a foreign country, they'll get one guy just for that one tour. Just so that they can help them settle into those conditions and bring that extra bit, something extra about from their experiences, from their experience of coaching in their home country. But then, of course, John Wright took over as India coach in the year 2000, which nobody thought would happen in India, because through the 90s, we had everyone from Madan Lal to the great Kapil Dev try their hands at coaching the Indian team. But John Wright... And with John Wright, who wrote a beautiful book as well about his coaching period there in India, what they realized was having an outsider helps, because he comes with no baggage in an Indian sense. That became a trend. And then a lot of other countries also by then had already started doing it. Now it's just become a very common thread. And Bangladesh actually have been very good with that. They've developed a lot of young coaches. There have been guys who coached the Bangladesh team and then grown. I mean, you look at and gone back to their home countries and become bigger coaches or more significant coaches. They've had a lot of Sri Lankans on board, from Champaka Ramanayake and Rohan Kalpage and Chandika Hathurasinghe, who's lives in Sydney. He's with the New South Wales cricket team, but he's had stints with Bangladesh. So they've had a Sri Lankan connection. They've had Courtney Walsh, the great Courtney Walsh, the first fast bowler to take 500 test wickets as bowling coach as well. And Dan Vittori, another legend of the game, played for New Zealand, took lots of wickets, played for a long time, nearly 20 years. So he was with them, like you said, but they want a spin bowling coach. And I mean, I will need two episodes to explain why cricket needs so many coaches, but I think it's like any other sport. Like in the NFL, you have a defense, and even like when it comes to, correct me if I'm wrong, defensive coaches or defense coaches, there'll be like many positions within that, right? Like, you know, and there's coaches for the offense line, things that I've learned by watching Remember the Titans, of course. Similarly, cricket has, it's such a complicated sport. There's a coaches for everything these days, from batting, fielding, spin bowling, fast bowling, and then there's a head coach and so on and so forth. So Rangana Herat, is a surprising name, because he, as far as I know, he doesn't have too much coaching experience. He only retired 2 years ago. He had a very interesting career. Started in 1999, but you know, he was always the second to Muthiah Muralidharan, who ended up with 800 test wickets. But once Muthiah Muralidharan finished, Rangana Herat's career took off like nobody else. He just was taking wickets for fun, and he became a cult figure, portly, short, I used to have a not so flattering name for him, which I don't think I should use on the show, but he was a wonderful cricketer, wonderful human being, and you know, someone you could see that you can learn a lot from, because he kept his cricket very simple, big-hearted guy. So I think it's a good, and unlike some wrestling websites which claim to be, you know, journalistic backgrounds, the Crick Buzz always, like, you know, they're very good with their reporting. It's a good website. I think you guys should check it out. So yeah, of course I work for them, so that was just a cheap, very cheap plug. It's good that Rangana Herath's been positioned. Sairaj Bahutale, you just asked me about the pronunciation. Bombay spinner, played a few test matches for India and a few players, but he's been coaching for quite a while. He's coached many state teams. He's coached Bombay. He's been part of the Rajasthan Royal setup for quite a while. So he came with a lot of experience. Saeed Ajmal, of course, had the 3-4 year dream run with Pakistan. But in terms of just credentials, Rangana Herath, as a cricketer, Rangana Herath, just like, there's no comparison. So maybe this is the start of something for him, and definitely a good signing for Bangladesh.
Oh, it's a great signing for them. I mean, Rangana Herath in Test has 433 wickets in only 93 matches. Like, that is super impressive in itself. And even in ODIs, he has 74 wickets in 71 matches. So there's that too. He's a premier spin bowler, and any side would be lucky to have him. But like you, coaching, he hasn't really done much of it. So if maybe that's not in his wheelhouse, then I mean, Saeed Ajmal, he's no slouch either. 178 wickets in 35 test matches, 184 wickets in 113 ODI matches. Those are impressive as well. I mean, can you also imagine how many wickets he would have taken if he played the same amount as Rangana Herath? Rangana Herath was averaging 4.65 wickets per match. Saeed Ajmal was averaging 5.09 wickets per match. So he would get close to, if not more than, Rangana Herath in the same amount of time. But, you know, both would be great options. Obviously, because I had to ask about the pronunciation, I don't know much about Saeed Ajmal to form an opinion about him. But, I mean, it sounds to me like with all three of these options, especially with what you were just saying about Saeed Ajmal, they're doing a great job of recruiting the right spin coach for their squad. Next topic, there has been a lot of speculation about Finn Balor possibly heading back to the main roster after his loss to WWE NXT champion Karrion Kross. It was reported by WrestleVotes that members of the Raw creative team have asked for Balor to return for months now. However, no edict has come down from the top to bring Balor back from NXT. It was also said that the NXT crew adores Balor, and unless the main roster has significant plans for him, he is likely to stay with NXT. Balor spoke with Ryan Satin of Fox Sports last week and said he would like to return to the main roster in the near future. Balor said, "I feel like in my last run there, I wasn't doing myself justice. I needed to change something, and the change came with NXT to kind of figure out who I was again. I've managed to do that to some level, and I'm definitely hopeful that a return to Raw or SmackDown will happen in the future." Balor has not been on the main roster since his loss to The Fiend Bray Wyatt. Is there significance in bringing Balor to the main roster now, or do you think NXT is a good spot for him until the main roster has something monumental for him? I think the main roster is where he needs to be, and here's why. When he first got called up there, he was presented as a huge star, not just some guy that came up from NXT. He was the center of that Raw show the very first night. And he was the center of attention on Raw until he got hurt in his match against Seth Rollins. And then from that point forward, it just kind of seemed like he wasn't going to get back to that level of stardom for whatever reason. It's great that he went back to NXT because he's been doing great things there, and he got back into that headspace and work rate that he feels he needs to be in. But when someone outright talks about his last run somewhere and is hopeful to return in their statement, I think it's time to let them go. The same could be said about any athlete on any sports team. If they're showing aspirations of wanting or hoping to be anywhere but where they are currently are, I mean, it's time to let them go. I mean, I'm not saying Balor is saying any of this or like because he resents or he's hating his time in NXT, but to me it's clear that from this statement he's ready to move on at any time, and why not now?
It's a fascinating journey that he's had, right? Like, I mean, you're right. Like, he was the first ever Universal Champion, and then before long, you know, he gets injured, and he that momentum he just couldn't regain. I think they tried different things with him. You know, he came in with a different gimmick of sorts, and then they put him into feuds that he just didn't seem to have the right chemistry with. He definitely did not have great chemistry with Bray Wyatt. They just, you could see that even like, you know, when they would be in the ring together, not just wrestling, but, you know, when he was reacting to the classic Bray Wyatt promos, he just, you could see it just wasn't organic. And you look at Finn Balor, he's outstanding athlete. He has so much to offer. He's good on the mic. He's great to watch. He's got a cult following, and he's just 39 years old. And they say in wrestling, unlike a lot of professional sport, you really come into your own in your 40s. And so he is speaking. So I agree with you. I think it's a good time to bring him back. And Raw can do with, you know, any kind of, and Raw can do with Finn Balor. Not so sure about SmackDown. I think they have a good thing going there, but, and bring him in, maybe, I don't know, maybe he can't, you don't throw him directly in to a feud with Bobby Lashley or, you know, into that mix. But I can definitely see a Finn Balor v. Drew McIntyre, Ireland v. Scotland, you know, a feud happening at some point. Like, you know, why not, right? I mean, you have so many nationality versus nationality feuds happening at all time. But I think it'll be interesting. It'll be like an interesting mix of promos. Maybe put Sheamus together with Finn Balor, do something. And he's just such a talent. I don't think he's right. He just did not find that rhythm after that first injury. When you think of Finn Balor in on Raw or SmackDown, does one feud jump out at you? Not really. One angle jump out at you? Not really. And it's not always on the writers. It's just that, you know, timing, as we know, it's so important, especially in wrestling. So, yeah, they really thought he was someone who could take them into the future, but it's not happened. And but he can definitely come back and be at that Seth Rollins level on Raw, like what Seth Rollins is on SmackDown, just slightly below the top. And there's so much you can do with him. And like I said, he's just 39, and he's a Tottenham Hotspurs fan, so I like him already.
Yeah, Raw can use all the help it can get. Jofra Archer is in a race against time to be fit for the first test against the touring Indian side later this summer. The 26-year-old, however, doesn't want to rush back into action and is determined to take his time after a make-or-break surgery to his elbow. Archer went under the knife to fix a long-standing problem with his elbow, a persistent niggle that has kept him out of games. Archer returned to playing county cricket last month, but could only muster 18 overs for Sussex against Kent before his elbow flared up again. He will now undergo a period of rehabilitation and will be assessed again in about 4 weeks' time. The ECB will take a call on his bowling fitness before taking a call on whether the speedster can take the field on August 4th in the first test against India. Archer wrote in his column for the Daily Mail, "Those are my targets. If I come back before then and manage to play in the home test series against India, then fine, so be it. If I don't, I am quite prepared to sit out the summer. One thing I am determined about post-elbow operation is not to rush my comeback, because my primary focus is to be playing for England in the 2020 World Cup and Ashes later this year." So, brother, should Jofra Archer focus on getting back as soon as possible, or is having the target of the T20 World Cup and the Ashes a better choice for him?
We touched upon it last week as well, Rajiv. I think he's on the money there. I said that I was pretty sure that the ECB would not want to rush him back. I think they have enough options for the English summer. like we spoke about Anderson and Broad will play in that first test. And, you know, they're going to try out new guys like Ollie Robinson is all set to make his debut maybe later today. Craig Overton's back. There's always the likes of Chris Woakes. And they have enough options going into that really big series against India in home conditions. But I think with Jofra Archer, I said this last week, with his body, he... with that action especially, he could be injury prone. He could be an injury waiting to happen, especially he's had so many issues with that elbow over the last 18 months. There's no point rushing him into, rushing him to play this summer. It's pretty late already. The summer's starting today officially. It's best to just, if he can be on track for that T20 World Cup in October. But I would, in fact, go the next step. I said they can still make do without him at the T20 World Cup. Of course, he adds so much to that bowling attack by just being there, the wicket taker that he is. But they will really need him for the Ashes. On these pitches, the way Jofra Archer bowls, and just the way he started his career against Australia 2 years ago in the Ashes, just amazing. And on that note, I was amazed to find out that the last time they played test matches in England with crowds, I was there. It was the last test at the Oval, the Ashes test. And The last time they played a test match at Lord's was also during that Ashes, when Jofra Archer made his debut and bowled that fearsome spell to Steve Smith, hit him in the head. It was nasty. you could feel everybody could feel the jitters there when you saw Steve Smith go down. So that's what I think England would want him to be really ready for. The last thing you want is for him to even play that T20 World Cup and pick up a niggle. Why risk it? They will need him to play. They will want him to play all five tests here in the Ashes. So if left to me, I would say forget about the T20 World Cup as well. Just focus on the Ashes.
Yeah, and when you talk about when he hit Steve Smith in the head, even my head started to hurt after I saw that happen. So you could feel it even here in America. And, you know, as much as I would love to see Jofra Archer in the Test Series versus India, I think he should wait for at least the T20 World Cup and the Ashes Series. I mean, Jofra Archer has, over the last couple of years, become one of my favorite bowlers, and I love watching him play. But we have seen him, we've seen this before with him, that returning too soon because he thinks he's okay turns out bad for him. I mean, yeah, everybody that's listening to this and has been listening to this knows I always root for India because they are my team. And yes, having him on the England side would be hurtful to India in the series. I acknowledge that. But I'm looking out for Jofra Archer, the player here. And as long as he takes care of himself and his body, he can have a very long and fruitful career ahead of him. Fix that bowling action like you were saying, so that way it doesn't put so much strain on his arm and his elbow, and you'll just go leaps and bounds further in your career than you even know. And it's not like India and England will never play each other again. I mean, if he stays healthy and able, he will be in many, many series against them in years to come. So I think he has a great mindset right now about focusing on, at the very least, the T20 World Cup and the Ashes, but bringing him back sooner than that T20 World Cup, I think will not benefit him whatsoever. AEW Double or Nothing took place this past Sunday, May 30th. Results included Hangman Adam Page defeating Brian Cage, the Young Bucks retaining the AEW Tag Team titles over Jon Moxley, Eddie and Eddie Kingston, Jungle Boy winning the Casino Battle Royale to get a future shot at the AEW World Championship, American Dream Cody Rhodes defeated Anthony Ogogo, Miro retained his TNT title over Lance Archer, Dr. Britt Baker defeated Hikaru Shida to become the new AEW Women's World Champion. Sting and Darby Allin defeated Scorpio Sky and Ethan Page. Kenny Omega retained the AEW World Championship over Orange Cassidy and Pac. And the Inner Circle defeated the Pinnacle in a stadium stampede match. Which match stood out the most to you? And which match was the biggest surprise for you, and which match did not live up to your expectations? So I'll go ahead and start, and here's why I'm going to start. Because I am going to state for the record here on Chop On, I stand corrected. Bharat and I a few weeks ago had a talk about, are fans in attendance necessary? And I flat out said fans are not needed if the story is good enough, which I still agree that if the story's good enough, fans are not required. But with that being said, the fans added to the show, without a doubt. They were on fire. The pop for Hangman Adam Page was enough to send chills down my spine. So for the record, right here on Chop On, I am stating I stand corrected. Now, that would be my biggest surprise, was that I felt that way. So now the card, it was amazing to see Sting doing all these things in that match when he was teaming up with Darby Allin against Scorpio Sky and Ethan Page that he hasn't done for years. I cringed when he was suplexed on the ramp, but once he jumped back up, all of my worry instantly faded and I was able to enjoy the match more instead of just sitting there, you know, all tense, wondering, is he going to be okay? Is he going to be okay? And I think that was the intention of that spot. Just get it out of the way right at the beginning, so that way everybody can enjoy the match. The best match on the card was without a doubt Dr. Britt Baker versus Hikaru Shida, and it wasn't even close. They absolutely tore it down. Great storytelling, the crowning of a champion that truly, truly deserves it. And then, of course, our buddy Tony Schiavone hugging her after the match was just the icing on the cake. The most disappointing was the Stadium Stampede match for me. Last year, I thought the Stadium Stampede match was great because it was something different and they were making the best of a bad situation. I mean, this one just dragged and dragged and dragged. There were a few fun moments, like Sean Spears sitting in that space with all those chairs around him, being the chairman, Wardlow and Hager just really going right after each other. And then there was that club scene with FTR, Santana and Ortiz and Conan. And then Sammy Guevara getting to drive the golf cart this time instead of actually being chased by the golf cart. Those were fun moments in the match. And other than those few fun moments, it just kind of dragged for me. Maybe it should have been about 10 minutes shorter, and that would have been great, especially with, you know, a 4-hour show. So those are my thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I'm not surprised at all with is the fact that I got you to agree on something that I told you, you will have to agree, which is wrestling is so dependent. It's such an emotion-based form of theater. You know me, I always refer to it as the greatest form of theater, and Eric agreed with me, is you need people. And one moment summed it up when Jungle Boy, you know, I don't know how many people had penciled in, like, you know, his name to win the casino battle royale, but that moment, just that pop that you heard, and not just like, you know, even when Britt Baker finally won the title, or there were so many moments during that event, and maybe most of the noise came from our brethren and our the female contingent led by Lauren from ad-free shows.
Highly likely.
Yeah, very, very likely. Especially some moments when I heard certain cheers, I knew that was coming from our ad-free show section. That's tough to say, ad-free show section. Anyway, I think for me, the most disappointing match is what I'll start with, get the negatives out of the way, was the Cody Rhodes-Anthony Agogo match. You heard me on For the Heat last week ask Eric and Conrad about whether this whole USA versus the world angle still works. Like, you know, has it run its course? And, you know, Eric said that maybe the timing was wrong. And I get it. I mean, it, like, you know, from the time, which Rocky was it? Rocky 3, Rocky 4, the famous one with Dolph Lundgren when Sylvester Stallone goes to very Soviet Russia. And
I think it was 4.
Yeah, it was 4. And yeah, when he goes, if I can change, you can change, everybody can change. And I still call it the most awkward ending of any movie. Like, you have this, sorry, I digress, but I always do. But you have like this whole movie based around a boxer and a boxing fight. And it's, you know, it's all about Rocky. And the last words that get mentioned on that show are, after he says, if I can change, you can change, everybody can change. And for my son, if you're watching me back home, I love you too. And I'm like, that's such a random way to end a movie. But anyway, we'll come to that some other day. But for me, that angle just failed. Like, Cody Rhodes' promo was great when he spoke about his own wife and his kid and all that. But yeah, it had, like, there's so many ways, other ways you could have built up. You're talking about a legit boxer coming into the ring. And we've seen in the past, boxing and wrestling aren't milk and cookies like cricket and wrestling are, or not the same flavor anyway. But I thought the build-up itself was odd, like more than disappointing. I just found it odd. Just a go-go just looked a little awkward at many points during that match. I mean, Cody Rhodes is a great performer. I mean, he can make most people look good. But I think he struggled as well to get a go-go going because not just because of the lack of experience for Anthony, but just, I don't know. I don't think the angle had enough heat. But this is personally, this is purely my opinion. But for me, I have to agree with you. Britt Baker winning, that was just a sensational build-up. Like, you know, I mean, if you ever want to know how to build up a character and take them to the top, I think AEW have nailed it with Britt Baker, and full credit to her as well. She's played that role amazingly well. I mean, it's not happened overnight. She's worked on it for many months now. And yeah, I mean, that was a great moment with her and Tony Schiavone. Like, we've heard Tony Schiavone speak so much about their friendship, and that was genuine. Like, that was genuine. I wouldn't say breaking the fourth wall, but you know, the closest you'll come to it. I know they've had like an on-screen friendship as well, but it was a great moment. Having said that, I thought a close second was the opening match. I mean, Hangman Page, and I thought that was really, I've not seen much of either of them, but you know, there was something about it. I think both of them could well be in for the almighty push, as Jim Ross would say. You know, it was almost like, and they always say, right, the first and the last, I mean, you either go first or you go last. And to see those two rather experienced, but guys who've not really got that big push in AEW do what they did was really good. The big surprise for me was Jungle Boy. I mean, he came from nowhere, and you know, he's just 23. He's been used as a, I wouldn't say a comic relief, but he's been that guy, right? He gets thrown around, and he's I mean, that whole David versus Goliath is what I'm sure they will use to build up his match with Kenny Omega, I think in 2 weeks' time, if I'm not mistaken, on Dynamite. I mean, that's just inevitable. I mean, what else, like, you know, little guy, whatever, young boy is 20, like I said, 23, and Kenny Omega is the bully right now in the wrestling world. So it'll be interesting to see, but not just the fact that he won, but just the pop he got. Like, you know, you could see that people were ready for Jungle Boy. I don't know if he realized that they were ready for him. So yeah, it's a great, great event. I mean, there's so much we can talk about. I thought Miro, or Rusev as he was called, finally becoming that character that we all hoped that Rusev would be allowed to become on WWE TV. I think he's finally mounted that. He had great momentum, if you remember, in the early days as Rusev, that amazing entrance in WrestleMania when he fought John Cena, and he was a brute, as they used to call him. But then I don't know what happened to, anyway, I mean, enough spoken about him over the years as Rusev. But yeah, that was another very impressive match. Even the tag team title bout, I think it was, you're getting to see, I saw one of the Young Bucks' wife tweet about, what is my husband doing here? That's a very cute tweet. They have really come into their own. And I was listening to Jim Ross this morning on Grilling JR. One really good point is he made was, they've not shown that level of toughness to them. And I mean, who better than John Moxley and Eddie Kingston to bring out that side of them, that they can go a little hardcore as well. So I thought that was really well done. So yeah, I mean, just a plus show for me by this is one of the best pay-per-views we've seen in a long time across promotions. And long may they grow.
I have to agree with you on that. And now it is time for everybody's favorite segment, Fact or Fiction. I will present a topic, and then we will say whether we think it's fact or fiction, and then we debate back and forth as to why we think that is. Our first statement today is, some players may not return from their home country for the IPL so that they can prepare for the T20 World Cup. Bharat, is that fact or is that fiction?
Well, I think it's the ultimate fact as of now. The BCCI had no other option but to go on and resume the IPL. We've spoken so many times on what's at stake. But having said that, how do you convince, for example, let's take Australia. I mean, the players finally got out of quarantine day before. You know, Pat Cummins could finally meet his pregnant wife after weeks of being away and then quarantined, away in the Maldives and in quarantining in Sydney. And then David Warner hadn't seen his daughters in months. So after all this, especially someone like David Warner, dropped as captain by the Sunrisers, was dropped in the last game, didn't play. I don't know how much motivation they'll have to enter another bubble. I know it's the IPL, but there's so much international cricket which is about to begin, like with this test match this evening, but just so much happening in the next 6-7 months. So I don't know how many Australians would go. Maybe the non-internationals like the Nathan Coulter-Niles and the Ben Cuttings of the world might be interested in going. Either ECB have already said that their players are not allowed to go. Bangladesh have now started. They've said Shakib and Mustafizur Rahman will not be given the no objection certificates to go. There's some talk that the West Indies board might allow some of their players to go. I mean, one way of looking at it is considering the UAE is where the T20 World Cup is going to be held in all likelihood, even though India has asked for an extension to finalize that. It might be a great experience because you finish the IPL and you immediately get into the UAE, into the T20 World Cup there. Every team is preparing for that event, playing series all over the world. So it could well be an India-dominated IPL, which is not that bad a thing for a lot of Indian domestic players, right? Like, it says maximum 4 overseas players. Nowhere does it say that you have to pick even 1 overseas player. There's no rule like that. So in a way, it's a good thing for a lot of Indian cricketers because all the Indian stars will be there for sure. So maybe the Indian Premier League will look like an Indian Premier League.
Yeah, it is definitely a fact. It's too close to the T20 World Cup tournament. They also haven't made it official where the T20 World Cup is going to be, so we don't know what the quarantine protocols are going to be in place. All we know is the IPL ends in October, and if it actually kickstarts in September, as hoped, and then the T20 World Cup will start pretty much immediately after, so players won't want to risk missing out on representing their home country, and what would be the point in them going to the IPL for a couple weeks and then going back to their home to quarantine again for a bigger tournament and then going back to wherever the World Cup is going to be and quarantine again. So I think you're right. Maybe some of the players that aren't doing much international cricket are going to go to the IPL and we'll see some names that maybe we haven't seen in a while or ever. But it's definitely going to be hard to bring back a lot of those big names that we were talking about for sure. Mark Henry will bring more legitimacy to AEW Rampage as the color analyst. Is that fact or fiction? I think it's a fact. Mark Henry has been a world champion in wrestling before. He has one of the more memorable angles in recent history with that fake retirement speech while John Cena was out there. And he's been in the Olympics. Having him in AEW in general is going to be huge for the company. It's not only going to provide legitimacy by commentating, but AEW can have him coach. He can be a great sounding board for the younger talents that are looking to improve. I mean, there's just so many positives with him coming in.
Oh, Mark Henry, from everything we've heard, is just an all-round good guy. Like, he's one of the really nicest guys in wrestling. Ever, maybe. We've heard so many good things about him from so many people, and you're absolutely right on all fronts. It is a fact. He he's one of those wrestlers who's not just proven himself as a wrestler or just around the wrestling ring or around the wrestling industry. He's done a lot of media work. I mean, Busted Open Radio has done a lot for them, and he's got that air of, he was not that bad a promo guy. He never got his due in my book, and not during his sexual chocolate days. But even with his sexual chocolate days, I thought he used to be so cute with that whole China angle when he was very raw. And I think his mic work developed over time. And I think he also fits the bill of being someone who came in very raw. And he kept improving. We've heard Jim Ross talk about it so many times. He was sent away to developmental. They were not happy with a lot of things, whether it was his attitude or just the way he was in the ring. but he improved and he kept improving. And often enough in any kind of field, especially in performance art or even for professional sport, it's those guys who know how to coach, right? Like they've reached the top of the game, but they've really had to had setbacks and they've grown, like, you know, as their career has gone. And they've always improved. They've always had to work at being better. They're not just that natural as maybe someone else, like maybe a Kurt Angle, who just took to wrestling so naturally, unlike Mark Henry. So, and it's like, you know, world's most strongest man. He's got so much, so much goodwill that he carries wherever he goes, and he's a legitimate superstar. So yeah, more power to him, more power to AEW.
It is absolutely right of the Afghanistan Cricket Board to blame Asghar Afghan for the loss against Zimbabwe and strip him of the captaincy. But is that fact or fiction?
Oh, it's ultimate fiction. I don't know what's happening in the Afghanistan Cricket Board. For such a young team, they've had a lot of controversy around captaincy. I remember 2019 World Cup, Gulbadin Naib was instated as captain, put in place as captain just before the tournament. Again, it was Asghar Afghan who was stripped of the captaincy. And I remember like their first game in the tournament was against Australia in Bristol. And you could see there was questions asked to him about it, like, and to Naib about it. And he skirted the issue. He didn't say much about what the rest of the team felt like with him as suddenly just being thrown into the role weeks before the tournament. And look, they've not played too many test cricket, but they've already had so many captains, like Rashid Khan as captain, Asghar Afghan as captain, and now they've gone with Azmatullah Shahidi, from what I hear. So absolute fiction. You can't drop a captain for losing, especially if you're Afghanistan and you do not get to play as much international cricket as you should. So there is something definitely up. There's always something up with Afghanistan cricket. We've seen issues with Mohammad Shehzad, the popular cult figure wicketkeeper that they had. So there's always, they're never short of drama for such a young cricketing nation.
Yeah, and it's hard to, when you keep changing your captain like that, it's hard to have consistency and build leadership. You can't build leadership if you don't know who's leading. So I agree, it's 100% fiction. To steal a term from wrestling, this is a clear case of the Afghanistan Cricket Board trying to fade the heat to somebody else. Yeah. Instead of just coming out and saying, hey, we did not do our best to provide our team with the tools to win, they needed someone to blame. And why not blame the captain that was on the field? Were some of his decisions questionable? I mean, maybe, but I also think that's a very subjective thing. One person could say it's questionable and another could say, no, he was helping his team win and here's the reasons why. So, I just think the Afghanistan Cricket Board was embarrassed by what happened. They got pretty much clean bowled by Zimbabwe. They just needed someone to blame. So they blamed Asghar Afghan. And I don't think that was the right way to go. Replacing Adnan Verk with Jimmy Smith on Raw, who is another non-wrestling announcer, is not the right move. Is that fact or fiction? It's a fact to me. This is WWE trying to be mainstream. Adnan worked with the MLB Network and ESPN. Jimmy Smith's worked in the MMA world. This is them trying to find someone who has a bit of cachet in a different market to bring more eyeballs to their product. As we've been talking about, I was a caller on Eric Bischoff's radio show For the Heat last week, which, by the way, Eric, if you guys haven't been listening to our show, Eric had put us over big on that show, and then one more time when you called. But I asked him if he thought this was WWE's way of trying to become more mainstream, and his answer was, "I hope not, and here's why: it's not a good reason to just bring them in." And Eric said himself, "A great play-by-play person is more valuable than any mainstream notoriety." And I agree with that. It's great for the talent if they have some sort of knowledge of the wrestling world. And my understanding is that Jimmy Smith has been working with Michael Cole, so maybe that's going to help him. But Adnan was only given 6 weeks to figure it out, and then they let him go. I mean, that's not enough time. He should have been given more time to either figure it out or just let him go like they did, but more time was needed, if you ask me. I mean, not everybody is going to be a JR or a Tony Schiavone or even Michael Cole himself, but this was not the right move. They should have found somebody in the wrestling world that could step in and take over now, not somebody else who's going to have to figure it out on the job.
I'm going to disagree. I think it's fiction. I think it might end up being the right move. I watched Raw just to listen to... He was on air this time, right?
Yes.
So before I go on raving about someone who I thought was Jimmy Smith. Now, they didn't, of course, mention too much about him, but already in that first show, he just seemed more comfortable with calling wrestling than Adnan worked it, you know. And not as in terms of getting facts wrong or, you know, getting moves wrong or monikers not wrong, but just the flow wasn't there with Adnan work, and he just didn't seem to connect with his co-commentators. But I just thought Jimmy Smith was better. But this is, we just have 1 week to go by. And working with Michael Cole will help. I mean, Michael Cole didn't start off as a wrestling announcer. He was a journalist. He was a radio journalist for many years. He covered many presidential campaigns before he got into wrestling. And he wasn't mainstream like these two. I mean, he wasn't a big name in the 90s when he came into the wrestling industry. But like Mark Henry, he's someone who has worked on his game. He's gotten better. I mean, he listened to Michael Cole in his early days, especially when Jim Ross was ill or when he was... fighting his Bell's palsy, and he was out. He was as, I wouldn't say it was bad, but he felt so out of place. You know, he would get excited at the wrong times, and he was, let's face it, he was filling Jim Ross's shoes that nobody else can. Maybe Tony Schiavone comes close, but it's not an easy job. But just listening to Jimmy Smith, I think we should give him some time. I think the WWE now have burned their hands once with Adnan Kirk. So maybe they had like lofty expectations because Adnan Kirk came with such like a great reputation. But getting Jimmy to work with Michael Cole is really going to help. And look, WWE are the past masters at getting mainstream attention and getting mainstream to somehow blend into wrestling. So I think we should give him some time, and I'm calling it fiction for now.
My only question about that would be, why didn't Adnan get the exact same treatment before he was on air? That's the only question I will have for WWE. And now it's time for terms and conditions with our resident expert, Bharat Sundaresan. So Bharat, we're going to start with wrestling. What is a disqualification in wrestling?
Well, technically, a disqualification is wrestling, is just a bad finish. But no, I mean, I've never been a big fan of DQ finishes. But a disqualification is basically, someone gets disqualified when you bend the rules, which is as basic an explanation as I can give. It's the same as your membership getting disqualified from somewhere, you being disqualified from class, or, you know, why does that happen? Because you breached a clause, you broke the law, or more than the law, I mean, you breached something. In a basic wrestling match, where you can't use weapons, where you are supposed to not throw open-fisted or close-fisted punches, where you're not allowed to use the rope for extra leverage, basically nothing where it's just a fair fight. You see it in boxing. Why do they check the boxers before the fight? They want to see if they're not carrying anything, if they clean it. They always call for a clean fight. And that's goes back to it is entertainment, but it's still sports entertainment. So there is a level of athletics, or there is a high level of skill, but there is a level of legitimate, or it is a legitimate sporting endeavor to some level, right? You know, they're still competing with each other. And when there is competition, organized competition, you need rules and regulations and laws. And that's what they have in place for wrestling. That's just a very basic explanation, but it depends on what kind of wrestling match there is. In a tag team match, it becomes even more complicated because there are four wrestlers in the ring in place of two. And then, of course, you have no disqualification matches where you can break any law you want to. But for some reason, wrestlers still prefer being in the ring in a non-DQ match. I've never understood that. Like, there's some things about wrestling is very difficult to understand, right? I mean, if I were to tell you that, you know, there are no rules that you need to follow, why would you still stick to the ring, except the fact that there are 28 cameras and that's where wrestling is at its best. But it's an interesting thing. But over the years, it's also been used as a way to protect your big stars. I mean, you know, when you want a big star to lose and you don't want him or her to lose clean, which basically means going down 1-2-3 or submitting to someone to say that I quit. The best way to do it is to find a loophole and get them disqualified. So, and also in most cases, a title doesn't change hands when there is a disqualification. So, I think while at the very base of it, it's just like anything else, it's about following the laws. I think it's just an excuse to, or not an excuse, it's a way out that bookers and writers use to protect talent or to find a finish or to extend a feud, like, you know, where you don't want a clean finish, you want it to progress. So it's just a tool. It's just another tool that they all use to enhance the wrestling business. Did I sum it up well, Rajiv?
Oh, absolutely. And I know you're going to sum this up really well too. What is a demerit point in cricket, and what purposes does that serve?
It's exactly the same, to be honest.
That's why I brought them together. You know, we got to marry these together. It's milk and cookies.
That's why you're the expert, man. You're the expert in the kitchen. For the record, I've never had milk and cookies together. It's not a very Indian way to.
Not at all.
I mean, the demerit system is in place, again, pretty much to keep the players in check, in line. You don't want anyone breaching the code of conduct. So, you know, it goes back to fair play and, you know, you want to play within the rules, but not just in terms of what you're doing with the bat and ball, but also in how you're conducting yourself on the field. I mean, you are role models, regardless of what level you're playing it at. And I mean, you don't want physical abuse or verbal abuse or, you know, any show of dissent to be normalized. And that's why they brought in the code of conduct. The demerit points came in only in 2016. Prior to that, there were level one and level two offenses where they used to levy fines. And if there was a level three offense, which rarely happened, they would ban them. But then the ICC or the MCC who bring in laws realized that we need to have a proper system in place so that this is monitored well. So demerit points were brought in 2016. And so within that, there are still four levels of offenses. So level one would be something very basic as, you just shook your head after you're given out. Like, so very minor social dissent. And then, of course, it gets more and more serious. Suppose level four is if you physically threaten the umpire or physically threaten a player. A year on, in 2017, they also brought in the card system. So technically, it's never happened in competitive cricket at this point. You can send a player off. It's never happened in cricket. But that was brought in 2017. But just to, you know, simplify the demerit point system, if you get demerit points, it sticks with you for 24 months. So they don't go away. So for example, on June 1st, 2021, I get demerit points, three demerit points for say, the umpire gave me out and I just shook my head and like stood there for more than like, you know, 15 seconds, like remonstrating with him, I might get three demerit points. So they will stick with me till June 1st, 2023. They won't go away. So in that time, if I accumulate four demerit points, I get either a one test or a 2 1-day suspension. So I'll serve the suspension, but the merits points, or so not the merits, the demerit points don't go away. They stick with me for 24 months. So it's basically was put in place to make sure that players who deliberately commit these misdemeanors repeatedly are punished. Like, you know, I mean, you might have this extremely well-behaved cricketer of Cheteshwar Pujara. Like, he might just be having a bad day. He might end up breaching some code of conduct. And you still get demerit point, but you know he's not going to repeat it again. So it's fine. But if you have someone who you know is on the edge or is slightly edgy, like if you know you have a heel in one of the teams and you know he's going to push the boundaries, push the laws often enough, so you just don't want them to get away with it. And that's why they brought in the demerit point system. And it's worked so far. I think close to 60 men and women cricketers around the world have got demerit points, but not too many of them have been suspended. So it's worked much better than the old system.
And now it is time to go over the ropes. This is where we go over the ropes of the present back into the past. So on June 1st, 1988, there was a WWF Superstars of Wrestling taping in Oakland, California, and Ray Traylor made his WWF debut as corrupt prison guard, the Big Boss Man. In his debut, the Big Boss Man defeated Louis Spicoli, and Ray Traylor's gimmick wasn't too far off from his job prior to becoming a wrestler. He was a corrections officer in Cobb County, Georgia, and Ray Traylor would then join Jim Crockett Promotions in 1985, then was repackaged as Big Bubba Rogers, the bodyguard for Jim Cornette. He would have an extensive feud with Dusty Rhodes throughout 1986, which we haven't seen yet on what happened when, but it's coming. It's definitely coming. Ray Traylor would leave Jim Crockett Promotions for the Universal Wrestling Federation run by Bill Watts in 1987 and quickly won their heavyweight title as Big Bubba Rogers. He would wrestle for the WWF from the 1988 taping until 1993, when he would jump back to WCW, where he would start wrestling as The Boss. In light of legal complaints from WWF regarding the similarity of The Boss to Big Boss Man, Traylor was then renamed to The Guardian Angel. Ray Traylor would eventually leave WCW in 1998 and return to the WWF as The Big Boss Man. He would stay with the WWF until it completely transitioned to WWE and was released in 2003. Ray Traylor, unfortunately, would pass away due to a heart attack on September 22nd, 2004. He was just 41 years old at the time. He would be inducted into the Hall of Fame, the WWE Hall of Fame in 2016, with his wife and daughters accepting the award on his behalf. Brother, I know that I personally didn't appreciate him enough during his time, but what did you think of the Big Boss Man or the Boss or the Guardian Angel or any of these other gimmicks that Ray Traylor had?
Well, I mean, the Big Boss Man had two runs with the WWE. I mean, there were two versions of the Big Boss Man. The first one, of course, you know, he ended up feuding with Hulk Hogan pretty much soon after he entered the WWE, like you said. And that's the Big Boss Man that I remember seeing for the first time, and he was a legit badass. You know, you didn't mess with him. Wasn't the greatest promo, but yeah, he was good in the ring, and he was a proper heel. Like, you wanted to be, wanted to just leave him alone. Like, you know, you could just, so to the extent that when I started listening to wrestling podcasts and people started telling me that he was like maybe the nicest man ever in wrestling, you were surprised. That means he played his part better than anyone else, right? Like, he was just the ultimate heel. He played it really well. Of course, he had that forgettable feud with Chains, who, yeah, again, the other end of the spectrum when it comes to being a nice person from everything we've heard on wrestling podcasts. Yeah, he was just, and for such a big guy, he had such great moves. The way he would slide out of the ring and then slide back in, and he was genuinely one of the best big guys ever, I think. Of course, then he came back now in a black suit. I remember that wasn't a great comeback when Vince, the Austin McMahon feud was just picking up. He came as the enforcer for Vince McMahon. And I mean, that stint was more comical than the first one. He was nearly hung to death by the Undertaker, if you remember, in the cage. So, yeah, forgettable run. I mean, I watched a little bit of him in the WCW, but yeah, I mean, he used to pair up with the Steiner brothers briefly. Yeah, but he never really got going. So for me, the Big Boss Man, the first version of Big Boss Man in the WWF, and I think for a lot of people, I think that was the best of Ray trailer we saw in the mainstream wrestling sphere. But having said that, I'm very keen to now listen to how the Big Bubba character grows on what happened when or how it grew in 1986. So pairing up with Jim Cornette couldn't start on a better note. But yeah, I mean, it's so good to know when you hear about, so sad that he passed away so young, but to hear so many people across promotions say such nice things about him. It's just a pity that he's not around and we don't hear more from him and not just about him.
He would definitely be a Zoom candidate for ad-free shows. Oh. That is for sure. And everybody would probably love it. But yeah, thank you everybody for tuning in this week to Chop On. We really appreciate all the love and support we have received. We've gotten a lot of really good feedback over the last few weeks. And we drop every Wednesday here in the U.S. at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Thursdays in India and Australia at 6 a.m. IST and 10 a.m. ACST. Brother, any last words for our listeners before we head out of here?
No, just lots and lots of love to all our listeners. And yeah, I mean, keep supporting us. I'm just happy that we've been very disciplined. Thanks to Rajiv. It's all, just to put it out there, Rajiv does all the hard work. I'm just, I just sit and talk. So shower all your love towards Rajiv, and maybe you can pass some on to me if there's there are any leftovers. But it's been great fun, I can't wait for next week. I really, by the time it's Sunday, I start waiting for an email to drop into my box, just like, you know, with the format for the next season. So for the next episode. So it's been great fun, and thank you for the support.
And thank you, brother, for those kind words. I really appreciate it. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at ChopOnPod. On Twitter, he is at BeastieBoy07. I am at TheRajiv8. Keep chopping on, people.